Welcome to Rooster Radio, where we talk to interesting people doing amazing things. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. Now, the South Start Conference has been and gone for 2018, but we're keeping up the momentum with another world-class founder, Toby Pierce. Toby and his fiancée, Kayla Itsinas, are behind the remarkable Adelaide-based fitness empire, Sweat, which is hitting around $100 million in annual revenue and saw the couple's wealth valued at $486 million on the AFR Young Rich list in 2018. The company was initially built on the back of Kayla's unbelievable social media presence, which, by the way, has passed 10 million followers on Instagram and 23 mil on Facebook, and their product, the Bikini Body Guide, giving users a workout plan, nutrition information, recipes, and more. Now, Sweat is becoming the Netflix of health and fitness, with millions around the world consuming content on a monthly subscription via the Sweat app. It's hard to believe that just 10 years ago, Toby was homeless and trying to find his way in life. We talk about his personal journey and meeting Kayla. We go deep into the mechanics of how the duo built this amazing company and the strategy behind it. Toby also talks about managing rapid growth, leadership, dealing with success in the limelight, building in Adelaide, and so much more. Toby is a fascinating guy with plenty of surprises, including a musical background, which may just be one of the secrets to his success. Enjoy the chat.
Toby, welcome to Rooster Radio.
Thanks for having me, guys. Really excited to be here.
Now, I love this question because it informs a lot about
you. Love your own question. That's how you're starting off this interview.
And Toby, you'll be lucky if I don't answer my own question.
All right.
But what were you like as a child? What were you like as a 10-year-old?
That's a pretty interesting question, but we'll dive right in. I think probably a little bit of a dichotomy, if I'm really honest. So probably like polar opposite ends of the spectrum. So like on one hand, I was, you know, probably extremely introverted, you know, like self kind of like motivated to do computer stuff, build stuff, you know, played classical piano by myself, like, you know, many hours a day on one hand. And then the entire like opposite end of the spectrum, I was like, no, like I want to play football. Like I want to do cool stuff and be cool and, you know, really loud and kind of probably a little bit, I don't know, maybe not so well behaved at all times. So kind of both ends of the spectrum.
And in life, it feels to me like you're constantly searching for, well, which one am I? And a lot of people spend a lot of their life trying to be one or the other. When did you realize that it was maybe that is you? You're both of those things.
I think, yeah, whether the realization was that or perhaps that, you know, it wasn't so much about like who I was to other people. It was more about what I wanted to do. And, you know, and I think that was probably, you know, kind of after high school at university. You know, I think a lot of people kind of go through that transition in life where it's like, oh, well, you know, I'm not at school around the people all day, every day. I don't have to fit in and blend and whatever. I can be independent. I can kind of, you know, I can go where I want to go today and do what I want to do today. And, you know, so I think for me, that bit of freedom at that point in my life was pretty pivotal.
Before we get into all the business stuff, I just want to pick up on the piano thing because I hadn't heard that before, hadn't read about that.
Yeah.
Tell us, when did you first start playing it? Like how much of a commitment was that for you in those early years?
Yeah, pretty massive. So I think, I don't know exactly when I first started playing piano, but I was doing just music and stuff in general, probably from about 3 or 4 years old, I think. You know, I studied classical piano like really seriously up until I was probably about 17. At one point, I was performing at, at Elder Hall at Adelaide Uni. I was studying at a pretty decent level. Had like 3 teachers at one point, and one of them was some, really epic, like, but short, powerful Russian woman who was this, you know, like a, yeah, she was a,
I'm picturing a movie character.
No, like, yeah, literally though. I feel like when I say that, everyone instantly knows who I'm talking about. You just kind of go, imagine, you know, me being this kid tapping away at a piano and getting hit with a ruler on my hands and, you know, that type of stuff. But, I was definitely into it. Probably, a good 3 or 4 hours practice someday. Did it quite competitively. I know that probably sounds weird, but you can compete with piano and with music. They've got competitions you can do. So I did a lot of that sort of stuff, but yeah.
I was just going to say the level of discipline, like is that something that was instilled in you, do you think, through that process?
Yeah, I definitely think, I think probably two things. Yeah, I think discipline is definitely one thing and attention to detail. So, you know, cause in music and especially like with, you know, romanticism, like classical period piano, there's this notion of like, well, yeah, you can like hit every key, you know, and that's obviously important. But then there's also, you know, the interpretation, the detail of the music itself from an emotional perspective. So very often people in, you know, competitions or in exams and whatever who will get great scores, it's not always actually just about accuracy. It's more about, you know, was your performance and interpretation of that piece kind of spot on with what it was? So it's probably sounds perhaps a little weird, but it's a, it's
no,
a really
I mean, it's why we love live music, isn't it? Because it's not, you know, a carbon copy of what you've heard before.
Yeah.
How did, I guess, those early passions, I guess, inform, you know, and direct your skills and capabilities, you know, into your business world? Do you reflect back and go, I can see why that helped me?
Oh, 100%. I think probably because, like, especially with music, you know, it's a really good example. So I was, when I was, you know, 13, 14 years old, I was, you know, doing equivalent basically to a PhD level in like classical performance. You know, so if you go to university and do like a PhD in music and solo performance, you will study at a particular level. That's kind of what I was studying at. And, you know, I had this, you know, interesting transition where I was, you know, again, kind of writing back to people in school. Oh, I love like playing the piano and classical music, but no one has any idea what I'm doing. They've never heard of it. It's not cool and funky and, you know, whatever, right? No one cared about it. So I kept doing that and on the side basically like studied like how to write music. And so by the time I was 14 or 15, I was writing a whole bunch of my own piano music. I'd do some contemporary stuff, some jazz, some blues, you know, whatever, because it was cool. But part of that, obviously, if you unravel it, is really, oh, well, you know, I was curious. You know, I kind of realized I had a problem I wanted to solve. And that problem was, how do I play or write cool music? Okay, cool. Where do I have to go to learn? How do I learn? How do I piece that together? You know, so I think that's really similar to a business. You know, it's like, oh, well, yeah, we really want to do this thing over here. I have no experience in that. Where do I learn? You know, what am I trying to do? Like, how do I become a overnight expert in that sort of thing? So a lot of parallels between being good at sport or music or whatever, and I think running a business, that's for sure.
I love hearing like a fit bloke who plays footy who talks about, you know, maybe playing piano and writing some jazz and stuff on the weekend as being uncool and wanting to fit in. It's like every girl's dream. Maybe not in year nine, but like...
Yeah.
But I guess on that, I mean, you know, it has been reported that like, you know, your teenage years were challenging. I mean, how would you describe, I guess, those years, and how they've continued to, I guess, shape you?
Yeah, sure. Well, look, I mean, I think everyone has their own kind of, you know, their own difficulties and whatever in life in one way or another, right? You know, mine were probably more centered around, you know, my family, I think, at that point in my life. And I think from an emotional perspective, you know, it really just helped me to build resilience, you know, and, you know, like being in a leadership position now, like running a business and whatever, like that's probably one of the core competencies of anyone who runs a business that grows and leads a team. Like, you can't be swayed emotionally, you know, all the time, because you need to be leading people. You know, there's a, from a leadership perspective, there's a whole bunch of research, and, you know, one of the interesting stats is that, you know, like from an emotional standpoint and a behavioral standpoint, like 70% of the vibe and behavior of the employees of a business is driven by that of the leader and the single leader, right? You know, so being able to, you know, having gone through that journey as a kid, you know, and then being able to build some resilience has definitely helped from a business perspective.
As a teenager with so much going on, you know, from the classical piano through to whatever the challenges might have been, you know, as a 16, 17 year old, what did you think your future was going to be?
That's a pretty good question. I think, I'm probably a little different to most people. And even, you know, when I was going through some of my more difficult times, I kind of always had this, you know, we could perhaps label it confidence. We could perhaps label it maybe naivety. I don't know, you know, but I just kind of always felt, I'm like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know where I'm going to be. But I have complete confidence in my ability to do something. And, you know, like, so I was like, oh, you know, like my goal was, I just want to have enough money to pay rent and you know, have my own place and, you know, live a normal life. Cool. That's a problem. Like, I have full confidence that at some point I can do something to achieve that. And so off I went and figured it out.
It's not often that the first kind of business question relates back to, I guess, where you then meet your future partner. Can you describe where you first met Kayla and what happened?
Yeah. I'm sure this would be like shock horror, but yeah, we met in a gym.
Oh, yeah. I thought you were going to say, like, I met my wife at the Havelock, which is a fairly Adelaide story.
The Havie,
she was serving beers and
yeah,
I was
like, yeah. No, probably, probably a bit different this one, but, I think probably quintessential Toby and Kayla. So yeah, you know, it's any
which
other
gym?
So I was working at Glenelg, what was called Genesis at the time. Kayla had sort of just started working, out of a studio that she'd built at her house. And then we both interestingly decided in the same week, well, I don't like training in my gym because I know everyone there and I can't get a good workout in. And she was like, I don't like training here because I'm just here all day. So we both went to, I think at the time it was called World Gym or Your World Fitness in the city. And both happened to be there at the same time, the same day, you know, whatever. And kind of was like, oh, hello. And
do you need a spot?
Yeah. I can help you lift that, bro. Yeah. Finally, that was probably my approach. But yeah, and then we just kind of talked for a bit and then shortly after we're catching up and yeah, pretty kind of, I don't know what normal is, but normal, I think at that point in time. So
with the relationship, does it grow in a linear approach in line with the business? Like,
well, not at all because so we'd been together for probably a year to a year and a half before we'd even kind of done anything. So at this point in time, so as I said, Kayla had kind of just started her studio stuff. I was working as a general PT in a gym, doing, you know, one-to-ones and small groups. I'd also just kind of at the same time, you know, parallel gone out on my own. And I was also doing, like consultancy and boot camp businesses. And so the boot camp was the one that kind of really took off. It was literally, you know, Wiggly Reserve at Glenelg, you know, like 20 or 30 women in the morning. I called it Bikini Body Boot Camp, and that was kind of where this whole, you know, thing with, training women and whatever for me began. Once Kayla and I sort of started dating, I think probably another 6 months after that, she was living over here in Unley with her family. And so I was like, oh, I'll open another boot camp in Unley because it's just convenient. And I'd kind of started living down this way. And then probably almost a year after that, we were sort of like, oh, well, we'd been working together on the boot camps. I'd helped her out with her studio. We'd do some social marketing together and it was kind of all coming along. And then that opportunity, you know, for an online product kind of, I guess, presented itself or we thought would be, you know, I guess viable. So we kind of, that was really only when we kind of actually kicked off together doing, you know, business together. Before that, it was just kind of informal.
Mm. And what was the output, I guess, of your first effort to maybe, you know, create some transactions or create some value that you were going to sell? What was the kind of catalyst?
So basically with social, we'd probably gathered maybe, I don't know, at the time was a lot of fans. I think maybe like 20 or 30,000 fans, on our accounts on Insta. And, you were sort of like, oh, well, like, you know, we've got these people who want what we're doing and they're watching our videos and looking at our stories. And we're sort of like, oh, we could just open like more boot camps.
Just pause there. Cause go back. Yep. I mean, everyone now goes, oh, 20,000 on Insta. Yeah, that's fair enough. But what year are we talking? Cause that probably was before.
This is 2013.
Okay. Yeah. And how did you? I mean, that would have happened fairly organically.
Yeah. So, from a, and again, this is the granular stuff. So if I.
No, we love this.
I guess like from a content distribution management for social media platforms at the time, Facebook had only just introduced algorithmic distribution of content. So in other words, rather than whatever accounts you follow, whatever they post, you see, like, that was happening not on Facebook, but on Instagram, they still had effectively like 100%, you know, distribution feed. So whatever you post was seen. And basically what that means is it's a really common strategy, you know, for social platforms early on because it develops a lot more. You generate like, you know, a whole bunch of like network effect, like really rapidly, whole bunch of ultra high engagement. It draws businesses and consumers to the platform and whatever. So we kind of, I guess, at least at this time, unknowingly, you know, kind of leveraged that. But yeah, so we'd kind of seen these requests coming through and we're like, oh, well, you know, we could just open boot camps everywhere. And I was like, oh, well, look, from a business perspective, like, you know, how do we control the quality? Like, how do we scale it? Like margins, this margins, that rules, whatever. And I was like, oh, you know, we can control digital stuff. So yeah, I know that ebooks are kind of a thing. Let's give that a crack. So, you know, sort of 6 months worth of, okay, I'll learn how to edit photos, take photos, learn how to build the website. What's PayPal? That's PayPal. Okay, cool. Anyway, and then at some point in time, we obviously launched the ebooks and that was kind of then off we went. So I think the first products were probably maybe 250 to 300 pages worth of workout content and 150 to 200 pages worth of nutrition content, spread across, you know, a massive chunk of like educational stuff. Cause that was kind of like a foundational, you know, piece to our, you know, training protocol. And then the smaller portion was actually like the workouts or the meal plan. So,
sorry, just quick, how much were you selling it for?
Initially, individually, they were $69.97. But together, you could get both of them $119.97, save $20. So bargain. Yeah.
So when you release it, was it instant like, oh shit, like this is fine.
Money in the bank.
Or was it like, oh, I'm not sure how this is going.
Yeah. So I think in some ways, yes and no. So we'd actually released, yeah, not a lot of people actually know this. We released the nutrition one shortly before we released the workout one. So we'd released the nutrition one and it did about 10 grand the first day. And that was like cool at the time. But like between the boot camps and my PT, I was probably doing, you know, the better part of that every week anyway. Like, so it was cool and it was great. But obviously then what happens, and very traditional with e-commerce businesses, then all of a sudden the traffic stops and you're like, oh, well, you know, we made the first bit of, you know, revenue, but then kind of, all right, now we just have to find more people, you know, and that then becomes a problem. But then about, I think a month and a half, 2 months after that, we then released the workout ebook, which was January the 4th, 2014. And, you know, that did like $70,000 on the first day with, you know, other than the expense to create the book, which was mostly offset by just personal time, was basically all profit. And that was obviously a lot more sizable than the 10,000. And that was kind of, oh, well, maybe there's a thing here. And that also kind of started to self-perpetuate over the next few days because people had been talking about it and their friends would come by it and whatever. And that was kind of like, oh, well, you know, not exactly going to quit my job and quit my uni degrees and whatever yet, but, yeah, we might be onto something.
And this, I mean, the way that you thought about your business back then, clearly, I mean, you would have been early 20s. Where did you just absorb this organically in up to this point or?
Yeah. So it'd all been pretty organic. I think, learning as we need, figuring out if something didn't work, just, oh, that's a problem, solve it, sort of really organic generation stuff. And even on like Instagram and whatever, I think, you know, we had an anecdotal, very opinionated view of what our consumers were, what our consumers wanted, you know, so we served them as best possible. And that was kind of, I mean, that was a really good value to have, but one that we didn't understand, which was basically like, oh, well, our consumers actually own us, you know, not the other way around. So how can we serve you?
Yep.
Now, obviously that's recognized as being a really big differentiation factor, but at the time we just thought that was kind of normal. Yeah. Cause as a PT, you don't go to them like, you have to train this way. They're like, oh, but I don't actually want to do that. I want to do this. So it's all about servicing them. It's not you, like you might be the trainer and coach them and whatever, but ultimately you've got to do what they want. Mm. So
was that, I guess, one of the main triggers of that early growth, that understanding that feedback loop?
Yeah. I mean, I think the feedback loop was a thing. We weren't necessarily really iterating our product like that rapidly at that point because it was an ebook. It's relatively static. You don't get a lot of like, you don't get data from your product. You get like just really kind of general word of mouth feedback on social and whatever. But the things that kind of really stimulated the growth early on were, you know, like, oh, well, you know, okay, like how do we get more people to the website? Right. Well, we need more social fans. How do we get more social fans? Okay. We need to create some sort of, you know, viral content. Cool. Great. Oh, we've got all these social fans coming to the website, but then we have no way of contacting them again. Oh, well, some businesses do email marketing. Oh, okay. Well, but what are we going to send people who are on our newsletter list? Oh. Oh, we'll send them blogs. Oh, okay, we write blogs. Okay, cool. Start writing blogs. Why do you write blogs? Oh, well, okay, engagement, SEO. Oh, what's SEO? Okay, that's SEO. And then so we just literally bit by bit, like on top of one another, started building this, you know, what I kind of refer now as to like our marketing ecosystem or a marketing infrastructure, which is effectively, you know, the machine that sits behind all of it that basically says like, how do we maximize the number of touch points we have with our consumers? How do we maximize the amount of data we have about our consumers? And how do we maximize the engagement, knowing that, you know, an increase in engagement obviously is an increase in throughput and conversion rate. And, you know, it flows on. You guys are marketing guys. I know you get it.
So. No, I'm nodding, but I'm also knowing that there's going to be that many people listening to our podcast right now with their pen out taking notes. So no, seriously, it's awesome. What point then did you start to get some press and be, recognized for separating yourself from the pack?
Yeah. So, if I recall my memory, it would have been May 2014. I think we got our first real like piece of media. It was actually a homepage feature on Female, which is a subsection of Daily Mail in the UK. I was actually sitting at, we were working out of a bedroom in our home that we were renting at the time. I literally was sitting there and got a text message from, this, you know, friend of mine that I grew up with, and they were like, I haven't spoken to you in literally like 5 years, but I live in the UK now. And I just like logged on, you know, to the news, and I think that this is your, you know, like your partner. And I was like,
So it wasn't PR driven. They just somehow came across.
Yeah. But of course, then when I looked at our Instagram growth charts and saw that we grew like 30,000 fans in a day, I was like, oh, well, that's obviously kind of valuable. And then so no different to the newsletter content SEO. I was like, oh, what is PR? Oh, that is PR. How can I use PR? Okay, cool. Strategy. And then that turned into, yeah. So that was one of the things, you know, digressing, but that was one of the things that stimulated the strategy around like, okay, how do we, you know, from a branding perspective, like how do we create the perception of us as being the one in the industry? Cool. Let's invest a couple hundred grand into running events globally where we train 4,000 or 5,000 women in stadiums. I'm pretty confident that will attract some attention. So we did that. That then was, you know, one of the stimulus for, I think we got probably upwards of $10 million worth of media that year, and, you know, homepage on Yahoo Health, you know, that sort of stuff. 43 front covers of women's health globally, like this, that, and the other. Like that was all quite strategic based on what is PR. Yeah, it all started with, oh, what's that thing? Yeah.
What some people may or may not realize, depending on how much they know of your story, is how fast this is happening, like over a period of time. How are you leveling up everything about your business, scaling up at this rate so that you can still transact. So
yeah.
You're building a team while you're doing it. Like you're sitting there, you know, as you're saying, you're learning about PR. You're learning on the fly while building a business. How are you actually doing that?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, obviously that there's reading. There's this great podcast, Rooster Radio. I've always kind of like what I mentioned about when I was, you know, when I was younger, like I'm always like, oh, like, how do I do that? Oh, I'll just figure it out. And I think also like from a, you know, probably from more, maybe a philosophical like standpoint, I don't really believe that I can be a good leader to a particular person if I don't at least have a decent base level of understanding about what they're doing. You know, so when we started hiring project management, like I read 3 or 4 project management books just to know what the language and the words were. You know, so when I'm having a conversation, I could get it. I think, you know, to add some velocity, you know, we went from, 150,000 fans at the beginning of 2014 to a couple of million by early 2015. We went from not having a product at the end of, you know, at the beginning of 2014 to having generated 10 million in revenue in the first year. Obviously like extremely aggressive growth, you know, working out of a spare bedroom with like 3 staff, like literally sitting on the ground or at a table, like eating me goring. You know, I'm sure you can picture that. You know, go from that to being in an office that was like basically just slightly bigger than the bedroom, you know, to buying a floor of a building to having a whole building.
We can't just let that sort of year slide just like that, because these are the moments that you see in movies, and everyone wants to know what it feels like to be on that trajectory. Like, how do you describe that sort of element of having disposable money? Or it might not be disposable. You might choose to say, I'm that invested in what we're doing. We're going to take out specific amounts and then we're going to reinvest. Like, how did you balance that at a relatively early age?
I think, yeah, the same principles around like risk management that you would apply to business, you know, about like, oh, how do we use the capital, like, you know, maintaining decent balance sheet, cash flow, this, that, and the other. I kind of also apply to my personal life. So obviously it was very strange going from like not really having much money at all, making what I thought was very, very good money as a personal trainer to literally having millions of dollars just, you know, from a business. There was really only 2 thoughts. Like one was, you know, what if we stop generating money? You know, and then the second one was, well, if that does happen, like, how are we going to create a system that allows us to generate money, whether it is the business or it is agnostic of the business? So obviously, you know, there was a personal side to that about how we manage that. But from a business perspective, it was more about, well, what we had done was great, you know, but like, what am I going to be doing in 10 years time?
You've mentioned a couple of times, but, you know, do you have a bit of a fear of like, just what happens if the tap is turned off? Like, is there a driving sort of fear that pushes you in this instance?
So at that point in time, definitely, yeah. Because, you know, how many stories have we heard about the rise to fame that then all of a sudden just disappeared? But I think, yeah, that very quickly kind of dissipated, you know, when faced with, okay, well, that's another month of growth and another month of growth. And okay, we tried this and that really worked. Okay, now we've got this team. Okay, cool. Now I understand this about business. Like, this is how to, you know, how to manage the money. This is how to manage the team. This is how to manage the growth in the future. And, you know, I say that full well, everything was hectic and broken at all moments in time. But
what was the most broken thing or the thing that caused you most anxiety through that phase?
I don't know. There's probably a pretty long list. But I think, if I'm really honest, probably in my mind, you know, I always viewed the largest risk as not consuming the opportunity when it is there. And so, you know, and that's both a good and bad mentality to have. It's great because obviously it forces you to move quickly. But obviously sometimes if you know, the way that you grade the opportunity isn't sound and isn't level, then you kind of end up pursuing the wrong stuff. Mm. One of the books I read kind of earlier on in my career was, one by Jim Collins called Good to Great. Yeah. And most people kind of go, oh yeah, I've read that. But the one thing that I took out of that was basically like, you do the one thing that you are really epic at. Like absolutely epic, like perfect it and just dominate it. And then when you've done that, focus on something else. But if you haven't like absolutely destroyed it, then you're probably not really ready for anything else. And so that, you know, really alone was like, oh, okay. Well, I'm probably pretty good at these things over here, but like I'm actually really good at that. So although I could probably make businesses out of this or we could grow the business by doing that, I'm like, I'm actually just going to focus over here. Mm. So
that when we talked about earlier, that focus, to really build, you know, I guess your following and build your business and not get sidetracked or sell out in the wrong areas too early. I mean, from the outside anyway, it seems like a very clear, distinct aspect of what you've done.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we like, so to maybe to add some more context to that, like, so I think we, like I said, we kind of launched in January. Yeah. Pretty good progress. By the time we got to March or April, you know, we'd done our first 100K a week and like, that was obviously a really cool achievement. And this was, you know, probably at that point where it was kind of like, it's less about fear of a tap being turned off and more about like, we have a sick opportunity here. But then the interesting conversation kind of was like, well, but what actually is the opportunity? Yeah. And like, so a lot of people on the outside would have been like, oh, but like Kayla's brand is huge. Like, you know, you could just dominate, like keep going, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, yeah, like, of course, right? But, you know, we were on track to kind of hit this point and slightly later on in the journey, you know, we got to this point, we're like, oh, you know, we've reached like 10 million people, you know, through social and this, that and the other and whatever. And I was like, cool. How do I reach 100 million people? Yeah. And like, so there's this notion, you know, like what's the biggest, hairiest, most audacious goal?
BHAG.
Yeah. The BHAG. You know, what's the BHAG? And that was kind of it. You know, and then I was like, okay, cool. Well, look, like reality is that no matter how great, you know, Kayla is, you know, I can love her as much as I like and the customers can love her as much as they like. But like, there's still only ever going to be a maximum amount of people, a ceiling that will ever consume that type of content within that demographic at this point in time, you know, through that medium. I was like, so, you know, okay, how do we break down those barriers? I'm like, cool. So more people, more training styles, more platforms, more accessibility, you know, lower barrier to entry for the consumer. So moving from $120 to, you know, a lower price point. How do we hit a price point? Oh, we'll just do subscription. So ongoing billing. Okay. But how do we constrain access if we've got a PDF? Okay, cool. We'll go to a mobile platform. Like, so a really, yeah, really logical sequence of events. Obviously a lot happening rapidly, but a very logical sequence of events. And so from managing the money side of thing, it was like, oh, well, we're here in 2014, 15, doing pretty good. How do we get to, you know, 2018 or 2019, 2020 and be five times the size, you know, be, you know, demonopolize the brand, you know, this, that and the other. And then so that was obviously where, you know, sweat kind of came in. And so then we built a strategy around how to pivot from 2014, 15 to now.
So how do you describe the brand and the business now?
So I think, one thing that relates to like every single person is basically that, you know, like, you know, as Netflix is to entertainment, like we are to fitness effectively, right? So, you know, Netflix is a platform which hosts a whole bunch of different content, like segmented by genre and style and whatever. We are a platform that hosts different fitness content, you know, segmented by genre, style, you know, discipline, however you want to view it. So that's effectively the way we currently kind of only have, you know, things like content that we've created. They've got created originals and licensed content. We don't do that. We just create our own, but effectively we're very similar. So.
And in terms of the, I mean, you just touched on it before, but you know, how do you drive revenue?
Yeah. So, obviously it's changed a lot. And this was, this was one of those like really great learnings that you have early on. You know, so you do all this planning and strategy, and you're like, oh, it's just gonna work. And then you factor in a small amount of, oh, we might make some mistakes, but even if we make like this absolutely silly mistake that we would never make, that you inevitably do make, it won't matter because we'll still succeed. So, you know, to put that into context, we went from, doing about $2.5 million a month selling ebooks, and then launching the app to doing $100,000 in ebooks and $800,000 in subs. So, yeah, it's a pretty low, when you drop 65% in revenue in the first month of launch after a product, you're kind of like, whoa, what happened? And all of a sudden, then that fear of, oh my God, the tap is now closing really starts to set in.
Did you sit down and after that month, look at the figures and actually stare it down and go, why? Or did you try 100%. To cover it up and be like, make some excuses?
No. I pretty much like dove into it head first, and I was like, well, like reality is the only person that's going to fix this is me. What I then realized, like shortly afterwards, that the unit economics that support an e-commerce, a traditional e-commerce model, so a single purchase e-commerce model versus the unit economics that uphold a subscription business are fundamentally different. So it actually turned out that although we had only done, the $800,000 in subscription revenue, it actually was not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've got, you've got accrued lifetime value, you've got, the customer acquisition cost, which kind of stops after acquisition, obviously.
They bought the book, then they're done. Yep. Versus now an opportunity to build that relationship with them.
Yeah. And then so over the next like couple of weeks, kind of did some very very like basic extrapolations. Said like, oh, we're actually like we're not necessarily heaps far ahead, but we're in an okay position. We'll push forward. Running your own business and, being the leader in that position, you're always kind of like, oh, that's why I figured it out. And then 3 months later, you're like, I hadn't figured it out. Now I figured it out. And then 3 months and you go through this cycle.
Cause in actual fact, you haven't turned the tap off. You've actually turned the tap on.
Yeah.
Haven't you?
Yeah. And to be honest, like we're realizing more and more now, like on a, like on a monthly basis that we're still only half on. Again, without like digging into the detail, but you've got like user acquisition modeling, monetization modeling and engagement modeling, like with subscription app businesses. We only really mastered like the acquisition phase. The other two are really sitting there kind of dormant that we're really starting to explore now. But just a lot of opportunity. And I mean, I would say that now, like two and a half years later, now I think I have actually figured it out.
We'll come back and talk to you in a year's time.
And I'll be like, I haven't figured it out.
On a personal level, how have you handled success? And, people know you. People know that you guys are making money.
Mm.
It's an interesting position to be in.
Yeah, so, really, like, literally until probably about 12 months ago, like, no one knew much about the business in terms of its, like, actual performance. There was just like, wow, you guys have lots of fans. And also, obviously, like, I kind of really deliberately, like, stayed behind the scenes because it's not about me. It's about what we can provide to, to our consumers. It's been an interesting journey. Like, to be honest, it's more weird for me to be like, wow, like, there's, the better part of 100 people here every day, like with me on this journey. Like that's weird, and coming to terms with that and, being, the insecurities about, oh, I'm interviewing a person who's twice my age to come and work for me. Like I feel weird about that. Like it's, it was a very surreal kind of journey, but I don't know. I think, if anything, like, it was just a really humbling process, like having gone through that. And I think for me, like I've never really necessarily like enjoyed or loved that side of it. I enjoy the building and growing stuff. Mm-hmm. And where we are as a company now still allows me to do that. And so I'm still heaps passionate about what's happening here. Mm-hmm. So
have you found anything interesting about, Adelaide's business culture? I mean, we talk a fair bit about it on the podcast. People have varying experiences, depending on your age and where you're at in your life. Conservative Adelaide versus Adelaide trying to break through. How have you found that?
Yeah. Well, I think, you only really know what you know, right? And so, we both, Kayla and I, kind of went from, running the business early in 2014 and not really having, we weren't very well traveled, definitely hadn't done any like overseas business and whatever, to literally like a few years later, done business in like 25 different countries.
Like, I'm off to Los Angeles again. I'll see you in a week.
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. And, so it was only really at that point that we were able to kind of make, a benchmark or a comparison. So it was like, oh, like, yeah, people in America are just like tremendously excited for you if you've had any degree of success. It doesn't, even if you're not making any money, if you're just like, I am trying, they're like, wow, congratulations. Whereas, in Australia and, you know, probably a little bit more Adelaide, it's not necessarily like that. And well, not for us anyway. To be honest, it hasn't probably really been until recently that there's been a huge amount of positivity around us, and support for what we've been doing. But yeah, there's definitely been varied experiences. Some definitely not as pleasant as others, but yeah, I mean, it's all part of the journey though, right? It comes with that.
How do you feel that you have developed? I mean, you talked about understanding yourself and knowing your weapons and dominating that. What are the areas you've felt you've worked at that has improved?
Yeah. I think communication's always been a really big thing for me. And I can see, there's a bit of nodding going on, by my team. But, I think, communication for me has been a big one. And I think, to speak to that really, that because I'm so and have been so ultra involved in so many different layers of the organization, and I spent so much time forcing myself to learn, and enjoying the learning, a lot of it kind of just makes sense to me. Yeah, but then when we bring in people who've obviously not been here and don't have the context, I'm kind of talking, and then I realize I'm like, I need to give you the context, and I need to help you to understand, not necessarily how to do your job and whatever, but why is that important right now? Yeah, and where are we going, and how can you contribute to getting there to make it meaningful for other people? That's definitely been a really big thing for me, and something I'm still really trying to work hard on now. But
because I'm assuming being a really good technician, it would be confronting to realize the success of your business is your ability to communicate to the people who are going to go and do it now.
Yeah. And so it's no longer oh, that's a good idea. It's no longer about how good you are or smart you are or whatever. It's about how big is the impact you can have on your team. You're how well can you say, how much enjoyment can you bring to your team, and how much motivation can you give to your team, and how can you help them level up? So part of our new recruitment onboarding process for a lot of people is literally for the first week you just pretty much meet people and read. Because we want you to understand, here's a whole bunch of specific learnings that we think you need to have in order to be successful here. And this is how we will help you on that journey. And that's had a pretty profound impact for the last couple of people who've brought into the team. So
you spend so much time learning, investing in your team, teaching. Who are the people that you've learned from? Who are the mentors, those key influences that have helped, even if it's just saying the right word at the right time, that have helped take you to a new level?
Yeah, that's definitely changed over the journey. If I'm really honest, up until probably 6 to 12 months ago, I'd never had a mentor, period. I don't know if it was because I was too busy or if I just, I tried with a few people here, but there was more. Yeah, we were doing some pretty unique things at that point in time as far as the world is concerned, not even just necessarily Adelaide. So I guess being in proximity with certain people and having contact and whatever was difficult. So it was a little bit limited at that point, and that's why, I delved into books, reading multiple books a week sort of thing, just absorbing as much information as possible. But now I've been really fortunate to network with some really tremendous people around the world. Whether they be in executive roles at some of the biggest companies in the planet, or whether they just be people who are, I've got an executive coach who's, he's a really, really wise person from a mentoring perspective to help me learn to deal with being a leader. I've got some great relationships. I wouldn't call them mentoring, but just relationships of people in America who are running multi-billion-dollar businesses. So I'm like, how do you communicate? How do you get that stuff across? And they're definitely invaluable relationships for me now, at this point in the journey, that's for sure.
It's hard to detect in the Adelaide bubble, but how is sweat perceived globally now? I mean, how do you articulate kind of where you do sit?
It's really quite interesting. I think, when we go to different countries, it obviously varies. In America, pretty much any woman between the age of 20 and probably 45, really, if we're in a restaurant, both Kayla or I will be recognized. They will know Kayla. They will probably know Sweat. They have used it or are using it, or their friend uses it, or they saw someone in the gym with it, or whatever. So it's definitely around. But I think, it varies country to country, that's for sure. But it's a pretty good perception. And I think, one of the really interesting things, very early on was, the conversion of, you know, with personal training, you know, in the real world, one-to-one in the gym or whatever, it's very easy to understand that, like, you could have a profound impact on that person. You know, but then when you travel over the other side of the world and some person has just, they've used your app, which has content, which obviously we love and we think is great and we're always trying to improve, but they say, like, you literally saved my life. It's like, wow. Yeah. And like, so it's, yeah, the way that we've kind of been, I guess, seen by the people and perceived has been, you know, both positive and great, but also like really quite interesting and fulfilling for us.
Mm. Now, Beggs, we're short on time, so we have to whip through our little rapid fire section pretty quickly, I reckon.
Absolutely. This is where we get to ask kind of a bit the slightly lame questions. Right. The only proviso is you're not allowed to sit on the fence, so you got to have an opinion.
Okay. All right.
Mine's not really, can I start first? It's not really a rapid answer, but what does a typical day look like from the moment you wake up to when you hit the sack?
Yeah, systemized. That's rapid fire.
He gets it better than you, and he's only been doing it for 20 seconds.
Well, we know it's rapid fire. That's the point.
There's general routine. All of that, you know, kind of corny stuff about trying to remove decision making and whatever. Like, but I mean, really, I try to get myself set up and prepared for the day. I'm extremely particular about like my food and my fitness and stuff. And that for me, like I believe creates a platform for longevity and success in my position as a leader now. Obviously there's long days. I'm up early in the morning. I'm in the office by 7 or 7:30.
What time are you up?
Yeah. 5:30 depends. Obviously when I'm traveling, it varies heaps, but, typically 5:30, in at the office or at least having my first meeting by 6:30 or 7, if it's not a conference call to America or here, in the office, work during the day, finish at, 5:36, always dinner at home or dinner with the family at 6 o'clock, like without fail, hanging around for whatever, go to the gym, come home, usually do some reading. After having worked out, and gym can be either, like weights and lifting weights and whatever, or it can be, I'm into jiu-jitsu as well. It's a new thing for me. Kind of reading and relaxing at home for a bit before going to bed. So.
Another interesting operator in the fitness world that you're, intrigued by?
Well, that's a good question. In the fitness world?
Well, I use that term like, maybe someone that you're just interested in that. I mean, I guess the essence of what I'm saying is like, it would be really easy just not to be passionate about fitness when it's your job all day, every day.
Yeah.
More someone who's doing something in around that space that I think is different.
I think athletes, like I think I look at a lot of athletes and the way they like run their lives. So, probably like, and like elite of the elite, like so someone like LeBron James, I can't pretend I'm an avid basketball fan, but I would look at someone like him and be like, how did you do what you do? Like, how do you do what you do now? Yeah. You know, what were your learnings and stuff like that?
What's the one job that you just really don't like? The one thing you have to do?
Admin. Sure. Yeah.
Two or three of your favorite podcasts at the moment besides Rooster Radio?
Yeah. Masters of Scale, Reid Hoffman. There's another one I've just started listening to. I'm not actually 100% sure on the name, but it's by Zora, which is a subscription, management service out of the States, owned by a guy called Tian Zhu, who's a really, really smart guy in the subscription space. But a lot of interesting business stuff there. And then probably, there's one called How I Built This as well.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
Last one from me. What's getting the most activity on your Spotify?
Spotify. Whew. Probably not as exciting as what people have
that's
before.
That's always interesting.
Sometimes we ask the cheesiest music we like, so you actually got away okay.
So classical undertone does kind of flow through. There's a piece called Chopin's Ballad, number one, Opus 23, number one in G minor. It's a piano piece. So I don't know if anyone's going to have any idea what that means
that
or like
awesome.
It, but
that is
I'm going to listen to that tonight.
Yeah.
My last question is, the most famous person that you've met that's you've had a bit of a fanboy moment with that you're like a little bit intimidated by?
I'm typically intimidated by a lot of people because I'm usually very excited about meeting them. I think maybe Jeff Williams. And Jeff Williams is COO of Apple. I think a combination of kind of maybe a bit of intimidation, but also just a little bit of awe. And I think you know, the degree of awe for any individual would probably be directly correlated with how much they know about, you know, that Apple as a company and the story and whatever. But, yeah, talking with him, you know, on a semi-regular basis when I go to America is pretty, like, he's profoundly intelligent, and wise, obviously, when it comes to business. And, yeah, you just learn things that you just don't really expect to learn. So.
Well, mate, talking about intelligence and wise beyond their years, I've loved the last hour, Monty. I'm sure you're the same. So, mate, really appreciate catching up with us in the very jam-packed schedule, providing the time to give us some insights into your story and to the an amazing business that is Sweat. So, thanks.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for having me, and hope someone likes the content.
Thanks, mate.
I hope you enjoyed our chat with Sweat founder Toby Pierce. Connect with Rooster Radio and listen to more than 100 interviews with interesting people doing amazing things at roosterradio.biz. And if you like what we're doing, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player. Thanks for listening.